This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Those unregulated, infamous derivatives and credit default swaps may soon be regulated if the Obama administration gets its way. Yesterday, the administration proposed regulations that would bring some light to the so-called shadow banking system. We'll talk about that proposal later. But first, why did the bankers, regulators, and ratings agencies collaborate to build and run a system that was doomed to self-destruct? My guest, Gillian Tett, asked that question at the beginning of her new book, Fool's Gold. It examines how the financial catastrophe happened by looking at the story of J.P. Morgan, a pillar of banking that developed and marketed credit default swaps and synthetic collateralized debt obligations, which played a critical role in the credit bubble and bust. Tett runs global markets coverage for the British international newspaper, The Financial Times. In March, she was named Journalist of the Year at the British Press Awards. The award cited her for being consistently in front of the curve as the world's economy went into meltdown. Gillian Tett, welcome to Fresh Air. Your book is really an overview of what went wrong through the case study of J.P. Morgan. Why did you choose J.P. Morgan?
Well, I wanted to tell the human story of some of the bankers who'd been involved in developing these products. And I wanted to go back to the time when many of the ideas and products that have come to play such a crucial role in this financial crisis sprang into life. And J.P. Morgan were very, very involved in the moment of creation in a lot of these products. You can actually see the way that the ideas were developed were initially intended to bring about great good for society and the economy. They thought they were building a more efficient, safer, better financial system. But unfortunately, it went very badly wrong.
So J.P. Morgan, among other things, popularized derivatives. So before we take the next step here, why don't you give a crack at explaining what derivatives are?
What derivative really refers to is a product whose value derives from something else. So imagine you had a bar of gold, and you thought the price of gold might rise or fall in the coming weeks. You could either try and trade that tangible gold, or you could actually write a contract that actually mimicked the way the gold price might behave. And essentially what's happened in the last few years is that bankers have realized it's easier to trade contracts which mimic the way that prices behave rather than trade the underlying tangible instrument itself.
So what are some of the new types of derivatives early on that J.P. Morgan created and popularized?
Well, the first types of derivatives that ever emerged were the commodity derivatives, contracts that allowed, say, wheat farmers to try and hedge or protect themselves against future fluctuations in wheat prices. Then in the 1980s, you had interest rate derivatives and currency derivatives, which J.P. Morgan got very involved in developing. The key creation moment, if you like, for what has driven the current crisis occurred in the early 1990s when the J.P. Morgan Group took some of the ideas that had been floating around in the interest rate derivative world and applied it to the banking sector, and above all else applied it to the idea of making loans and used derivatives to start trading the risk that somebody who had taken out a loan might not be able to repay, or the risk that somebody who'd actually had a bond out there might not be able to honour those bond payments. And that was really the key shift that occurred in the early 1990s. J.P. Morgan wasn't the bank that actually invented that idea. It was Bankers Trust who first actually had that bingo moment of trying to apply the interest rate concept to the credit concept. But what J.P. Morgan did was basically take that concept and build an entire marketplace that allowed it to go from simply being a sort of mad idea in one corner of a room somewhere into a fully fledged financial market that later grew to staggering proportions.
Now, are you talking about credit default swaps here?
Yes, I'm talking about credit default swaps, which basically fall in the category of instruments known as credit derivatives. And what those essentially do is say, here we have somebody who's got a loan or a bond outstanding, and there is a risk that might not be repaid. Now, that risk can either sit with the person who actually has made the loan or issued the bond, or you can try and trade it between investors and pass that risk on.
So why is that good for the bank if you pass the risk on?
Well, the original theory that drove the whole development of this market was that In the old days, banks had made loans and they were on the hook if people didn't repay those loans. So back in the savings and loans crisis, say, of the late 1980s and early 1990s, the banks that had made a lot of dumb loans, which then went sour, basically went bust because all their eggs were in one basket. They might have an awful lot of loans, say, to a particular place in Texas, and if something hit that Texas economy, then that bank would go bust. But the theory was that if you could actually start diversifying your portfolio, if you could start sharing the risk that you had to a particular pool of, say, mortgage holders or companies, and spread that out amongst a whole group of banks, say, or spread it out amongst a whole bunch of investors, then you'd actually have less concentrated risk to one particular region or one particular sector of the economy. It kind of worked on the basis of a problem shared is a problem halved, that it's better to actually have risk spread out in the system rather than just concentrated on one place.
Now, as you're saying, the premise behind this was that it would minimize risk for everybody and that risk shared is risk halved. But that's not the way it worked out in the long run. So, like, where did that go wrong?
Well, where it went wrong was on a number of different fronts. Firstly, when loans got sliced and diced and passed around a bunch of investors, it became very hard to work out who was actually responsible for checking out that the original loan was good quality or not. Back in the old days, when you had a small town banker, when they made a mortgage, they might go and actually meet the household that was taking out the mortgage, look them in the eye, check out that they were credible or not, and keep a close eye subsequently on whether or not that loan was being repaid. And they had an incentive to do that because that loan was on the books of the bank. There was a sense of responsibility and accountability. The problem came that when loans were being sliced and diced and chopped into pieces and passed around lots of different investors, the end investor who actually held that loan in its chopped up form didn't actually know who had taken out the mortgage originally, had very little way of actually monitoring whether or not they were going to repay that mortgage. And if they were passing it around the system, they might not actually feel much responsibility for actually checking that the mortgage was being repaid or not. There was a real breakdown in a sense of direct responsibility or accountability. And that basically encouraged bankers just to make more and more loans. If somebody could pass the loans on and chop them up and slice and dice them, there was no reason not to make the loan so long as they could pass it on to someone else. So that was one problem. The other big problem, though, was that as loans got sliced and diced and chopped around, it became very hard for an end investor to monitor the risks attached. And initially, no one really worried about that during the years of 2004, 2005, 2006, because there was a feeling that the housing market was okay and the credit markets were booming. And sure, people might not know what lies inside their bundles of debt, but it should be fine because guess what? You can always sell it on to somebody else. But when the mortgage market began to turn in 2006 and evidence piled up that actually the housing prices were starting to flatten off and there were reports that some mortgage holders, particularly in the subprime arena, were not paying back their mortgages, many investors who were holding bundles of debt linked to subprime mortgages started to say, well, how do we know this is safe or not? And then you had the equivalent of a food poisoning scare, a financial panic break out, as suddenly everybody went on strike and said, well, what do we think is safe? What is not safe? How can we trust anything? And that had devastating consequences, as we all know.
I want to ask you about why the J.P. Morgan team that was creating some of these products in the 90s worked out of the London office as opposed to the New York office?
Well, there's a very interesting story about regulation there, which is that because of the Glass-Steagall Act that came in the 1930s, essentially banks like J.P. Morgan had been limited to doing banking business, which is basically the business of gathering in deposits and lending it out to companies or consumers, and they'd been barred from going into the securities market. In London, by contrast, there hadn't been that kind of distinction. And so institutions were able to blur the lines much more effectively. And in the 1980s and 1990s, you had a lot of banks, a lot of American groups went over to London, built up a business that was not just making loans, but also getting involved in underwriting bonds, and then increasingly got involved in derivatives as well, which seemed to be a fairly natural development. So the fact that JP Morgan had a London office as well as its New York office, and in fact it had a very big London business, allowed it to start playing around with concepts in a more creative fashion than might have been possible back in America.
Now, you mentioned the Glass-Steagall Act that prevented banks from engaging in certain activities in the United States. That act was repealed in 1999, and the bill repealing it was signed by President Clinton. So did that change things at J.P. Morgan? Did a lot of the derivatives people move to New York after that?
Well, that trend had already been happening. And in fact, the key development of the credit derivatives market happened in the mid-1990s, actually, in New York. Because even before the Act was actually formally repealed in 1999, there had been quite a steady loosening of most of the rules before that. So in some ways, what happened in 1999 was really just a confirmation of the bigger trend that had been underway. But once the Act was repealed, really under the heavy lobbying by Citigroup and JP Morgan, as well as some of the other big banks, two or three things happened. Firstly, the whole idea of mixing up banking business with securities business and being very innovative in the way you handle bank loans, which is what cuts to the core of credit derivatives, that concept really took off with a vengeance. But secondly, because the walls were coming down between the different types of banks and suddenly they were all competing on the same playing field, and because that coincided with the explosion in the use of the internet and you had globalization, you had this kind of world is flat mentality coming to the fore, suddenly you had what had been quite a carefully segregated and controlled marketplace turn into this crazy free-for-all whereby everybody was competing with everyone else and really scrapping away, trying to become the biggest, the best, to grab more market share. And if one player in that pack was doing very well, say like Goldman Sachs, suddenly everyone wanted to be the same. And there was intense business pressures, intense demand by shareholders for all the banks to chase whatever profits as much as they can, as fast as they can, and to as big an extent as they could.
What problems did that competition lead to?
Well, the problem in banking is that in a capitalist system, banks are a business and they are there to make money for their shareholders. And so there's always pressure on them to do that. But at the same time, finance plays a utility function. If you can't push money around the economy, then basically the rest of the economy won't work. Now, in an ideal world, you hope that bankers are rational, common sense beings who are able to balance off those two functions and to push to chase profits for their shareholders, but also not to go completely crazy and not to forget that they also have a utility function as well. But in the new crazily competitive landscape that was ushered in at the beginning of this decade, many banks just didn't have the luxury of saying, well, we would like to have some profits, but not too many profits. And maybe we better take a long-term view. Maybe we better try and work out whether the business we're chasing is going to be sustainable in the long term. You had these shareholders clamoring for impressive quarterly earnings growth. And you can't have impressive quarterly earnings growth quarter after quarter if you're being cautious.
So you think that the competition helped lead banks to excesses?
Absolutely. There was a frenzy of competition where basically most of the bank CEOs felt under enormous pressure to deliver constant increases in profits almost at any cost or any long-term cost. And coming back to the issue of why I focused on JP Morgan, one of the really interesting aspects of the story is that although the JP Morgan group created the marketplace of credit derivatives and had many of the original creative moments, if you like, they spotted very early on the dangers that were inherent in the application of some of these products. So, for example, although they put corporate loans into these new structures they'd developed, they tried doing it with mortgages as well back in the late 1990s, and they realized after a couple of attempts that it just was too dangerous. They couldn't get the data they needed to judge whether or not these credit derivatives or mortgages were safe or not. So they stopped. They didn't carry on pursuing that idea, even though it might have been profitable. And the reason for that was partly because JP Morgan had a slightly unusual corporate culture. although it was driven by the need to make profits, it was less overtly commercial than most of its rivals, partly because it had this very long history, and partly because it had a very team-orientated internal dynamic. So J.P. Morgan walked away from some of the riskiest, craziest manifestations of its own brainchild, if you like. But subsequently, if you look at what happened in this decade, a bunch of other banks came in, saw what J.P. Morgan had done and copied it. And they didn't have the same caution at all. They took the mortgages, stuffed it into these products, and basically went mad in order to chase profits. And that's really where the trouble started and set in chain a series of events which we're all living with now.
Now, we were talking a little bit about some of the special products, the derivatives and credit default swaps that were created, and the good that some people thought that they would do and the problems that they ended up creating. Something else that was created within this whole system of the derivatives and the credit default swaps were shell companies with names like SPV, Special Purpose Vehicles, and SIV, Special Investment Vehicles. Would you explain the purpose of these shell companies and what they are?
Well, the best way to explain it is probably to imagine a house with a garage. And inside the house, you have all the nice bits that you like to live with. That's what people regard as actually being the house. But imagine you've got a garage as well in which you stuff things you just kind of don't want sitting inside the house. So maybe you've got a bit of junk. Maybe you've got a few things you want to hide from your visitors. It's sort of a place to put things that you just don't think are part of the main everyday life. Now, shell companies tended to operate in the same way for banks. And they had what they call their balance sheets, the books where they actually recorded their activity that they showed to regulators, showed to investors. That was the official part of the bank. And then you had these shell companies which were linked to banks but sometimes wouldn't appear on the balance sheets of the banks, sometimes would be holding assets that the banks just didn't really want to have inside their main balance sheet. There was a connection between the shell companies and the banks, but it wasn't formal, it wasn't always visible. And importantly, it often meant that in terms of the regulations that the banks needed to adhere to, the regulators would kind of ignore what was sitting inside the shell companies when they judged whether banks were safe or not.
And that's in part because some of these shell companies were offshore, like in the Cayman Islands, Bermuda, where they weren't taxable. And were they subject to regulation?
They were generally not subject to much in the way of regulation. I mean, the precise details varied enormously from country to country, and some banks were more open about their shell companies than others. But basically, they weren't. This was the hidden side of banking, the hidden face of banking. And originally, nobody worried too much about it because they seemed to be pretty small in scale. The banks were much bigger than the shell companies, and that was where most of the activity actually happened, was inside the banks. What essentially happened, though, this decade was that the activity inside the shell companies began to expand exponentially. And you got to a point where, by the middle of this decade, the type of credit that was being created through the shell companies, the financial flow through these shell companies, was often almost as big as that actually occurring inside the banks.
So it was kind of off limits to regulators, and also investors in the banks really didn't know the full story of the bank's balance sheets, because a lot of things that the banks didn't want investors to know about was hidden in these shell companies.
Absolutely. It was a crazy situation in retrospect. And for the most part, people ignored these shell companies. They ignored the off-balance sheet vehicles because they assumed they were ultra-safe and ultra-boring. And so, if you like, it was, you know, a shocking situation hidden in plain sight. Investors just were not asking hard questions. And for the most part, regulators weren't asking hard questions either. But the size of this shadow banking system, as it's sometimes called, is just breathtaking. I saw a study last week from some bankers and regulators which suggests that just before the credit bubble burst in early 2007, the shadow banking system in the United States was as big as the real banking system. And so it's as if we had a real banking system, the high street banks, the main street banks that everyone knows about, were sitting there, and people thought, okay, that's where our banking system is, that's where the financial flows are occurring, and they just watched that. But there was this entire shadowy phantom banking system sitting on the edges, widely ignored, which was just monstrous in scale.
Now, one of the things that was really crucial in the slice and dice mortgages and the credit default swaps catching on was that, like, a lot of the slice and dice mortgages got AAA ratings from the ratings groups like Moody's. And we've since learned that they were not nearly as safe as a AAA rating would lead you to believe. And I'm wondering, from the research you did, whether you think that Moody's was especially generous in their ratings, kind of like playing along, or whether they didn't comprehend the mathematical formulas or didn't foresee the mortgage crisis. Like, what explains the AAA rating as far as you can tell?
Well, basically, Moody's, S&P and Fitch, and all three large rating agencies, and those are the three largest ones, were pretty much of a muchness, and they all tended to do the same thing. They had these models which implied that actually AAA made sense. They had these wonderfully complicated mathematical programs which looked at all these mortgages and said, okay, so what's happened in the past in the subprime world? What's happened to mortgages? What's the default rate been like? Well, it kind of looks fine, and so it gets a AAA. And the problem was that precisely because they were operating these very rarefied, complex mathematical models, they lost sight of what was happening on the ground amongst real-life human beings. The people who were modeling this stuff almost never went out to a subprime community themselves. It was all theory. It was all numbers on a screen. So they kind of lost sense with the fact that actually models are only useful if the past is a good guide to what's going to happen in the future. They don't work if the world around them is changing so fast that you can't actually model it. There were always some people in the rating agencies who realized that, but they didn't have much of an incentive to speak out because the rating agencies were taking fat fees from the banks to produce the correct ratings. So there really wasn't a lot of upside for the rating agencies to say no.
And the AAA ratings enabled the banks to cut their capital reserves, and that helped lead to the meltdown too. Can you explain the connection there?
Well, in the old days, when a bank made a loan and it kept it on its books, it had to set aside reserves to make sure that if that loan went bad, the bank was able to meet the loss. So in the old days, if you made a $100 loan, you had to set aside $8 usually. The precise amount of money you had to set aside varied according to the rating. And over time, that got more and more sophisticated. So by the middle of this decade, if something carried a AAA rating, then a bank only had to set aside, say, $1, $2, $3 against a $100 loan. So that was one reason why the banks began to hold less and less capital relative to the amount of loans they'd made. Or to put it another way, they began to pump out more and more loans on the same pool of reserves. But in addition to that, when the banks began to sell those loans on, or sell the risk of those loans on using derivatives, that enabled them to cut the amount of reserve they had even more. So in some cases, you had situations where a bank might have been involved in producing, say, $100 worth of subprime securities, which had all been sliced and diced and chopped up, but it might actually only end up holding, say, 50 cents against the risk that those could turn sour.
So we've been talking about some pretty complicated things that are hard to understand. And I'm going to ask you about something that baffles me that isn't a financial product or banking regulation. It's about you. You started covering the financial world for the Financial Times in 2005. And you immediately, more or less, started to write cautionary things about what was going on with the shadow banking world. And this was before most financial reporters were talking about that. And you weren't even from the financial world. I mean, your background is in cultural anthropology or social anthropology. So why is it that you, who were not from the world of finance, started covering finance in 2005 and pretty immediately got onto this story?
Well, when I was an anthropologist, I did my fieldwork out in Soviet Tajikistan. And what you basically do as an anthropologist is to try and do a grassroots, holistic study of how all the pieces work together and look not just at the parts of society that people want to talk about, but also, more importantly, the parts they don't want to talk about. So I tried to apply that to the financial world, and what immediately struck me in 2004 was that the media on both sides of the Atlantic was writing obsessively about the equity market and about M&A. That was a glamorous high-status stuff. But they were almost entirely ignoring this vast debt and derivatives world, this credit world, because it was regarded as boring, low status, a bit dull, etc., etc. So, in fact, in 2004, I wrote a series of memos and spoke to my editor and said, listen, I think there's a story developing out there that we need to cover. And it became very clear to me that there was an extraordinary revolution happening in the way that finance operates. And the only thing that was more extraordinary than the scale of that revolution was the fact that it was almost completely ignored by politicians, regulators, ordinary consumers, and to a large degree by journalists as well. And that really alarmed me, because history shows that whenever you have an area of activity that's occurring in a very frenzied manner, which is being ignored by everybody else, but basically is in the hands of a particular elite, a small group of people, there is tremendous potential for overreach, excess, for manias to develop. And that's exactly what happened.
I don't know if you've seen this or not, but there's a big story in the Columbia Journalism Review by Dean Strakeman called Power Problem. The business press did everything but take on the institutions that brought down the financial system. And he writes in that article, the public should be aware, warned, that its interests and those of the business press may not be in perfect alignment. The business press exists within the Wall Street and corporate subculture and understandably must adopt its customs and idioms, the better to translate them for the rest of us. Still, it relies on those institutions for its stories. Do you agree with that perception, that the business press's interests aren't in perfect alignment with the rest of us, that they're more about the Wall Street and corporate culture?
I would certainly agree that the business press is in a very difficult cultural translation position. In order to get a glimpse of what's happening inside the business world, they have to learn to speak the language of Wall Street. They have to learn to speak the language of financial markets. And they need to deal with the business community on a regular basis. And so on one level, they need to go native, if you like, to use some anthropological idioms. But on the other hand, in order to then translate what's happening and set it in a wider context for the rest of society, they have to try to keep a sense of context and judgment. And one of the problems is that it's very hard to do that, to play that cultural translation role, when they have no time and resources. And one of the problems in the financial journalism in recent years was that anybody who actually understood what was happening inside the credit system tended to be working for the credit system, because guess what? They could be paid by bankers a hell of a lot more money than, say, if they were working inside a newspaper. The bankers had enormous power. They had huge amounts of money to throw at public relations efforts. And so there was a pretty unequal power balance there. The other big problem, though, is one of having a silo mentality, which is that it suited bankers very well in recent years to try to regard their activity as a self-contained little bubble. And if a journalist writes something nasty about banks, then often they will bully, threaten, try to browbeat that journalist. And I know that because I was at the receiving end of that a lot back in 2006, early 2007, when I was writing things about the credit markets that the big banks didn't like. The really pernicious problem, though, is that in order to write things that banks may not like or big businesses may not like, you need time and resources. You have to dig deep.
Now, you said you were bullied by institutions that you were investigating. Can you tell us a little bit about how they tried to bully you?
Well, it would be a combination of ways. It would either be through not talking to you, and I was subject to that on occasion, or it would be they'd call you in and harangue you and say, why are you writing such nasty negative pieces about the credit world? I remember I was called in to see a senior banker in London in early 2007, who said to me, you know, why do you keep writing that the world of structured credit is murky and opaque? It's not murky. Anybody can see the numbers they want if they look on a Bloomberg machine. So I asked him, well, what happens to that 99.9% of humanity that doesn't have a Bloomberg machine? What are they supposed to do? Don't they have a right to know what's happening inside the financial system? And there was a 10-second pause, and it occurred to me that actually he'd probably never even bothered to think about what that part of the Bloomberg free world actually even thought about. I mean, it's like, you know, there was this incredible silo mentality amongst the banking world.
Are you finding any, was gratification the right word, in knowing that you were right when everyone was telling you you were wrong?
No, I'm absolutely shocked by the consequences of the bubble now having burst, because they are actually dramatically worse than I ever expected. Although I saw 2 or 3 years ago that something was happening that was not sustainable, I never dreamt that the subsequent crash would be as bad as it has been. And I just desperately hope that we can learn the lessons collectively of the need to have better oversight and transparency going forward to make sure that this type of terrible bubble doesn't occur again. Human greed will never disappear, and the tendencies of bankers to basically go mad in the pursuit of profit will never disappear. But the best checks and balances to prevent that running completely out of control is to have transparency, oversight, and non-bankers watching what the bankers are doing.
Gillian Tett is the author of Fool's Gold. She oversees global markets coverage for the Financial Times. After we recorded our interview yesterday, the Obama administration sent a proposal to Congress laying out a plan to regulate derivatives and credit default swaps. So we invited Tett back today for an update. My guest, Gillian Tett, oversees global markets coverage for the Financial Times and is the author of the new book, Fool's Gold. What are the regulations that President Obama is proposing?
Well, essentially, he's trying to do several things. On the one hand, he's trying to make sure that as much trading in derivatives as possible is cleared through a centralized platform. What that basically means is that instead of banks cutting derivatives deals in private where regulators can't see them, they'll be going through a single centralized system so that they can be better monitored. At the same time, he's also trying to make sure that all the banks and hedge funds and insurance companies that trade in derivatives have enough of a capital cushion to make sure that if there are any losses, they can basically survive those losses without going down. And both of those points are critical because the derivatives world has been very opaque in recent years, and many institutions have been trading derivatives without much of a capital cushion.
So what could have been avoided if derivatives and credit default swaps were regulated all along in the way that President Obama is proposing they be regulated now?
Well, a number of things could have been avoided. Firstly, you would have avoided a situation where a group like AIG had massive derivative contracts on its books for which it had absolutely no meaningful capital cushion. And the reason why AIG was able to get away with that was partly because it really kind of fell through the regulatory cracks in the system. So going forward, what the government wants to do is make sure that big insurance companies are covered with the same kind of rules as banks and everyone else. Secondly, one of the big problems in the last 6 months during the financial crisis has been that investors and regulators had no way of telling who was holding the risk in derivatives contracts and just how big those risks were. So they basically panicked, and lots of investors said, I've got no idea just how risky other institutions are. I'm going to stop trading with everybody and basically go on strike. So what people hope in Washington is that by introducing more clarity and more of a centralized system into what's been a freewheeling bilateral world, you'll actually have more confidence in the system as well, particularly if a crisis hits.
Now, you know how you were describing the shell companies, the SPVs and the SIVs, where a lot of companies hid their more toxic assets offshore, off the books, so that investors wouldn't know about them? Does this regulation that the president is proposing affect those shell companies?
Well, this regulation is not directly targeted at the shell companies specifically. But yes, it is highly likely that it's going to be harder for banks and insurance companies and hedge funds to conduct the type of crazy deals they were doing through shell companies in recent years quite so easily in the future.
Now, there's a lot of details about the plan that we've still got to see. And to be honest, you know, lawyers and bankers are poring over this stuff right now, trying to thrash out what they actually mean. But certainly the principle has been established that you can't just duck and weave around all the rules and run whatever derivatives you want on the idea that somehow this is all part of free market enterprise and the government should keep out and that deregulation is a good thing. That's been the dominant mantra for the last 9 years, all through the Greenspan era. And essentially what Geithner and the other Washington administration officials are saying is that era of extreme deregulation, of freewheeling, do what you want in the name of American capitalism, that era is now over, and they want to try and introduce more state controls.
There's a finance lobby group, the ISDA, which stands for the International Swaps and Derivatives Association. And, of course, they were one of the forces behind the deregulation of derivatives and credit default swaps. Do you know what they have to say so far about President Obama's plan?
Well, in public, they're treading pretty carefully because they know which way the political wind is blowing. And so they've issued some fairly careful statement saying they'll work with the administration. In private, they're seething because the reality is that ISDA has been fighting for 20 years to stop regulation of the credit derivatives world in a heavy-handed way, or rather to stop the derivatives regulation of the entire derivatives world. And they've fought off regulation three times, once in the late 1980s, once in the early 1990s, and then in 2000, Congress passed an act which effectively seemed to nail the door shut on regulation for good. I mean, people in ISDA told me that effectively the 2000 Act had, quotes, nailed the door shut on regulation of the derivatives world. But now, having won that battle three times and having actually become pretty complacent in recent years, they're discovering that the door is being blown wide open again, and Geithner appears pretty determined to overturn not just the specifics of the 2000 Act, but the general principles as well.
I'd really like to hear what you think about this, since you've been covering swaps and derivatives so carefully for the last few years. They've gotten the global economy into so much trouble. Are they worth saving and regulating, or should we try to get rid of them? Are they that dangerous that we should try to just abolish them?
Well, to be perfectly honest, that's an idea I've been wrestling with myself. And the fact is that in theory, there could be many, many valuable benefits of derivatives. And there are many valuable benefits of derivatives because the type of derivatives that are useful, that don't get much press, are things like contracts which allow companies that trade overseas to protect themselves against future swings in currencies or to protect themselves against future rises in interest rates. And in theory, the idea of companies being able to protect themselves against the chance of another creditor going default is a good thing. The problem is that they have been so badly abused and used for speculation rather than for actual risk mitigation that they've actually increased the risk in the system. They haven't reduced it. So at the very least, if derivatives are going to play a useful function going forward, they have to be made standardized, transparent, and easily monitored, not just by the bankers, but by everyone else too.
Gillian Tett, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Gillian Tett oversees global markets coverage for the Financial Times and is the author of the new book, Fool's Gold. For her first summer reading review, book critic Maureen Corrigan has sidestepped the usual suspects in mystery fiction and decided to turn the searchlight on a writer's writer whose name is not yet posted on the reading public's most wanted list. Here's her review.
I was all set to do a big mystery roundup for this week. One of those, hey, let's get a jump on summer cavalcades of crime and suspense novels. But as any student of detective fiction knows, the minute you think you've hatched a good plan, the universe throws a wrench into the works. Every time I started to write my pay-in to the predictable excellence of new crime novels by George Pelicanos and Michael Connelly, a little guy kept muscling into my consciousness, complaining about how those bestseller boys always steal the spotlight. This wise guy writer's name is Reed Farrell Coleman, and he made a good case for himself. Admittedly, I haven't been able to stop thinking about his Mo Prager mystery series ever since one of God's own divine messengers on Earth, that is, an independent bookseller, recommended it to me last year. If life were fair, Coleman would be as celebrated as Pelecanos and Connolly. Then again, if life were fair, a hard-boiled poet like Coleman would have nothing to write about. Read Farrell Coleman. With a triple-decker, sterling silver handle like that, Coleman should be the headmaster of Choate instead of a working stiff who, I kid you not, holds down a day job as a commercial truck driver licensed to drive hazardous materials like nuclear waste. A Brooklyn boy who came of age in New York City's noir period of the 1970s, Coleman found his calling when he took a night school class in detective fiction at Brooklyn College. Pelecanos and Raymond Chandler also took similar routes to hard-boiled greatness. Coleman has written several different mystery series, has won a slew of major mystery awards, and is admired by his colleagues. Some of those famous tough guys and gals have even written heartfelt introductions to the Mo Prager novels, which were originally brought out by major publishing houses, but are currently being kept in print by small presses, Busted Flush Press and Bleak House. There are 5 novels in the Mo Prager series, and together they do what only the low-rent genre of series fiction can do. They compose a slow, evolving saga, set mostly in and around Coney Island. Mo, our hero, is that iconic hard-boiled character, a too-smart-for-his-own-good ex-cop turned private eye. He makes a crucial mistake in the first novel, called Walking the Perfect Square. He lies to a woman named Katie, who will become his wife, about the true fate of her missing college student brother. Mo lies out of kindness and thus ignores one of the golden rules of the noir world. That is, no good deed goes unpunished. That original sin of Mo's past haunts the novels and accrues in awful power as they go on. By the last novel in the series, graced with the Chandler-esque title, Empty Ever After, you're basically wishing for the doomed Mo to be put out of his existential misery. The fact that throughout most of the series, it's Mo's own monstrous father-in-law who's torturing him with the threat of spilling the truth to Katie is simply Coleman's own delicious spin on the dysfunctional family theme that's a staple of classic American detective fiction. Coleman is a pro at executing all the other standard hard-boiled elements like brooding atmosphere and loop-de-loop plot lines. But it's Mo's New York Jewish, part yuppie, part blue-collar, insider-outsider sensibility that's the fresh draw here. In my favorite novel of the series, Redemption Street, Mo travels to the crumbling Catskills Resort area to solve an age-old mystery, there's the past again, at a burned-out hotel. After wisecracking with a small-town local woman who looks blankly back at him, Mo reflects, sarcasm isn't a universal language. That's the thing most New Yorkers forget when they venture beyond the city limits. Most Americans don't spend 80% of their waking hours constructing witty comebacks and snide remarks. Not everyone acts as if they're on stage at the Improv or trying to outwit Groucho Marx or George Bernard Shaw. Most people say what needs to be said and shut up. He's right, and in honor of the wisdom of Mo's sociological insight, I'll stop acting like the native New Yorker I am and say what needs to be said and then shut up. Reed Farrell Coleman is a terrific writer. If mysteries are your poison of choice, hunt his up. It may take you a little longer to nab them, but you'll appreciate them all the more for that.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed the Mo Prager novels by Reed Farrell Coleman. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org.